Bibi Net, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu are, I think I can say, there are few people in this world who understand the nature of the true nature of this regime. They understand this regime is a threat to them. And the question for them is not the oil prices. The main question is that whether the, how can I put it, you know, temporary raising oil prices or any commodity worth to in order to eliminate, this is very important, to eliminate Hitler, Nazi fascism, and his racist agenda. Is it worth or not? That's the question.
Because Vahid, there, I'm afraid we must leave it. We're almost out of time. Vahid Beheshti, thank you very much. Coming up is Asma Mir in the house, ready to take over when we come out of this program at the top of the hour. But from me, Mark Urban on Times at One, that's all. I'll be with you again tomorrow.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Asma Mir on Times Radio. Coming up on the show today, Sir Keir Starmer says the UK won't be drawn into a wider war with Iran as attention turns to the crucial Strait of Hormuz. We'll speak to the Red Cross. £1 billion to tackle youth unemployment, but will it actually create any jobs? The Federation of Small Businesses and the National Union of Students will tell us what the plan could mean for employers and young people. Should we have access to AI tools that mimic famous authors? The tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker will bring us the latest from the digital world. And from smartwatches to smart collars, why some owners are now tracking their dog's activity like a canine Strava. But first, the news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer says a decision on how to reopen the Strait of Hormuz may be some time away. Donald Trump has demanded that seven countries help to unblock the waterway, which carries a fifth of the world's oil. The Prime Minister stressed this would need a coalition of countries. Here's the Times' Whitehall editor, Ben Clatworthy.
The key messages were that we should that de-escalation is the way to maintain stability, but also the big message was cost of living. And he was saying that the way to keep the cost of living down is through de-escalation. The longer the war goes on, the worse the pain is going to be domestically.
The Prime Minister has also pledged £53 million in extra support for those households that are most exposed to rising heating oil prices. Labour covered the cost of a specialist tax lawyer hired to look into Angela Rayner's finances in the lead-up to her resignation last year. Jonathan Peacock KC spent up to 5 days examining her finances, providing a draft and final legal advice about the purchase of a £700,000 flat in Hove. Senior Labour sources have described it as a shameful use of party membership fees and trade union donations when this had nothing to do with her role as deputy leader. Here's the Times' chief political correspondent, Aubrey Allegretti.
Angela Rayner will potentially be asked to sort of explain herself by some colleagues. Her allies say effectively that she didn't ask for this legal advice. It was a KC that spent 5 days looking into all of her tax affairs, not just the stamp duty issue. And they say Labour commissioned it, not her. But I think there will still be questions about the cost and whether or not she should have paid it herself.
A judge has called a nursery worker an incorrigible and dangerous paedophile as he was jailed for 24 years for sexually abusing children. Nathan Bennett's victims in Bristol were just 2 and 3 years old. The alarm was raised when his actions were picked up on CCTV, watched by staff. Senior Crown Prosecutor Gemma Kneebone says Bennett's offending was amongst the most appalling and upsetting she's ever seen.
When we send our children to school or to preschool or to nursery each day, we do so trusting that they will be cared for and kept safe. Bennett took advantage of that trust, seeking out a profession that gave him access to the most vulnerable of victims.
Elsewhere, tributes have been paid to a genuinely caring schoolgirl who's died of meningitis in an outbreak that has also killed a University of Kent student. It's left 11 more from the Canterbury area seriously ill in hospital. Amelia McElroy, head teacher of Queen Elizabeth's Grammar School in Faversham, confirmed that a Year 13 pupil she named as Juliet has died. The University of Kent has moved its exams online as a result of the outbreak. One of the people in hospital is believed to be in a coma. And Chelsea Football Club have been fined £10 million and handed a suspended transfer ban after admitting making £47 million in secret payments to unregistered agents in third-party over transfers between 2011 and 2018. The club also handed an immediate nine-month ban on academy transfers. And remember, the Times' finest football writers preview and review the week's football on The Game podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover today. Coming up, we're giving a £3,000 grant to employers to take on young people who've been on benefits, make a dent in youth unemployment. Donald Trump says it would be very bad for the future of NATO if allies don't help secure the Strait of Hormuz. We'll find out from someone whose job it is to monitor shipping lanes what is actually going on there and whose ships are managing to get through. Do you have a tracker for your dog? It's a thing, apparently. Is it for security or do you just like to count its steps? And we'll bring you everything you need to know about tech, about money, and about books. And of course, I would love to hear from you today. You're already texting in. It's been a while. You can text the show on 87222 or you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. Now, the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon, in reverse order, of course, number three is Labour paid for a lawyer to advise on Angela Rayner's tax affairs. Hiring the specialist barrister could have cost tens of thousands of pounds. It's been described as a shameful use of party resources. The second most read story is expats fleeing Dubai fear increased UK tax bills. HM Revenue and Customs asked for clarity about whether British people escaping Iranian drone strikes in the UAE will be penalised if they've spent more than 183 days in the UK. And of course, the most read piece on the Times website is Iran latest. Keir Starmer says Britain will not be dragged into wider war. The Prime Minister resists the US President's call to send warships to help secure the Strait of Hormuz as Dubai airport is hit in a drone strike. And of course, you can read all the articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, get one. It's probably the safest thing to do. Just go to thetimes.com/subscribe. If you are a digital subscriber to The Times and The Sunday Times, it's not just today's articles you can read, of course. You can also access the full archive online. And what an archive it is, including the in-depth interviews from the weekend's papers over the last couple of days. For example, we've had revealing interviews with Martin Clunes and Rosamund Pike. And if you want to read those, plus all the features from the Saturday and Sunday Times, just head to our website or app and check them out. Right, it is 6 minutes past two. £1 billion to get young people back into work. This is the government's latest plan to tackle youth unemployment. Ministers want to create 200,000 jobs, offering businesses £3,000 to hire an 18 to 24 year old who's been out of work for 6 months, plus extra incentives for apprenticeships. The Work and Pensions Secretary Pat McFadden unveiled the measures this morning, arguing that the issue of youth unemployment could not be blamed entirely on Labour policies.
Now, I know that business costs matter, and of course we're mindful of them, but this issue is deep-rooted and it's long-term. The number of young people not in education, employment or training is too high, at almost 1 million. And almost all of the recent rise took place before the last election. And within this total, the proportion of the young people who say they can't work because they're sick or disabled has doubled. It's now around 45% of the total.
There's a lot of figures in there, but it is clearly a very sticky problem. With that many young people not in education, employment or training, will today's announcement make a difference? Let's speak first of all to Tina McKenzie, who is the UK policy chair at the Federation of Small Business. That's my first guest. Good afternoon to you, Tina.
Afternoon.
Now, Pat McFadden was very keen to tell us this morning on Times Radio that the Federation of Small Businesses thinks that this is a game changer. So why is it a game changer?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking to Pat McFadden and actually previous governments about this. The fact that actually in the UK, it is the small and medium businesses that are more likely to hire people that have been off on long-term, either on long-term sick or off unemployed for a longer time. And if they wanted these younger, especially the younger 1 million NEETs, if they want to get them back into work, they're going to have to support small businesses to actually hire them and actually put investment into them. And with the cost of hiring people at the moment, as well as the other pressures on businesses, then they were stopping hiring. And we know that from quarter four, the amount of businesses hiring just dropped completely. So it really was clear to us that if you want small businesses to hire people who are out of work and have been for quite a while, then you are going to have to support them financially because things are just so tight at the moment. So the £3,000 hiring incentive, and that's for all businesses, I think is fantastic. I think it'll go some way to helping get more people unemployed back into work. And then I also think that the apprenticeship, now this is specifically for small businesses, the apprenticeships are fully funded and there's an extra £2,000 there if you take on an apprenticeship if you're a small an apprentice sorry if you're a small business
right.
they are financial supports that should help and encourage small businesses to make that leap and take another headcount on.
Right. Do you think, I mean, again, from speaking to small businesses, is there a feeling that another way of doing this, of making it more palatable and desirable to hire more people, would be to reverse the increase in employers' NI?
Absolutely. I mean, that goes without saying that as soon as you increase any sort of costs on hiring labour, it really makes people think twice about it. And it's very expensive now to hire people. The minimum wage, obviously, for young people goes from £10 to £10.85 on the 1st of April. We know that they're bringing in 3 days sick pay that wasn't in before, pushing that on to employers now from the 1st of April as well as many other measures. It's just so expensive to be running a business right now. However, this is slightly different. Yeah. And I don't think, we have those increases in the national insurance. This is different in that this is targeted specifically at 18 to 24-year-olds. And it is those 18 to 24-year-olds that have been unemployed for 6 months. So I think it's a very targeted intervention, which is really trying to hit that 1 million NEETs number and bring that down. So I think it's a slightly different thing than just cutting national insurance. Because remember, for younger people, you're not paying national insurance anyway.
No, it's a blanket improvement, I suppose, that some people have been talking about for some time and you've acknowledged that. What guarantee is there, though, that these businesses get £3,000 if they hire an 18 to 24-year-old who's been out of work for 6 months? But how long do they have to keep hold of them for?
Well, the final detail on that has to come out, but there's no guarantee in anything in employment. At the end of the day, you know, businesses, demand goes up, demand goes down, businesses change all the time. But equally, you know, someone may start a job and decide that job's not for them and may leave after 3 to 6 months. But generally, when people start a job, then you're therefore as a country, you're not paying the benefits cost. Secondly, those people then start to generate tax for us. So it's a no-brainer. The £3,000, I mean, you can nearly make it £10,000 as an incentive to employers because that's how much the Treasury will get in tax from these young people. So for us as a country, it's an absolute no-brainer. What, you know, we are going to make money out of having people back to work, which, more importantly, you know, we know when people are in work that their mental health is better, they have better quality of life, they have better self-esteem. The longer we leave these young people sitting at home with nothing, the harder it is for them to get back into work. And then we know it impacts their health as well.
Okay, Tina.
And mental health.
Tina, thank you very much. Tina McKenzie, UK Policy Chair at the Federation of Small Businesses. Let's also speak to Amira Campbell, who is the UK President of the National Union of Students, to find out what this actually does mean for young people. Good afternoon to you, Amira.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
So you've heard there, Tina McKenzie's enthusiastic about it. She, the Federation of Small Business, says this is a game changer. Are you similarly enthusiastic?
Well, actually, I think there's a lot of shared relief about this announcement, because it's the government really turning around and saying they're going to do something. Firstly, the expansion of this work for those up to the age of 24 is massive for so many young people, particularly those who've just come out of study or have found various different periods of challenges getting into employment. And this investment is so pivotal at a time where businesses really are struggling. And I know Tina has touched on that. It's brilliant that the government are stepping in and taking action. However, there are some concerns, right? We have to have a conversation about the fact that we don't know how long this is going to last for those young people. For people that have been out of work for 6 months, or even in some cases, 18 months, based on which scheme we're talking about, we've got young people that have not been working for a long time and are really going to need that support. And then fundamentally, investment, brilliant. That's what this is. But it's also got to be partnered with plans for progression for those young people. And so we need to see real consultation and support for those businesses in terms of how they're going to support those young people to gain experience to that leads to progression and opportunities. But those also make sure that we're having conversations led with young people about what the real barriers for them for progression and for work are.
Mm-hmm. There is already apparently, there's a jobs guarantee that young people will get a 6 month job if they're on universal credit, and they've been looking for work for 18 months. And that is also going to be expanded under this announcement from 18 to 21 year olds to 24 year olds. That's a 6 month job. How helpful might that be? I mean, I suppose really what we're talking about here is guarantees that have to be built in. I mean, who is it, whose voice is going to be there trying to check or demanding that, you know, you can announce something and it can affect a lot of young people and it can get their hopes up and it can, you know, have them in employment for a specific amount of time. But what happens at the end of it?
Right. And this is where there needs to be some real look into what happens afterwards. I mean, I think fundamentally the jobs guarantee speaks to a government that's listening to the fact that young people are out of work, that the economy is not working for young people, and that they need to do something. It's really promising. But they need to hear all of the other things that come alongside this. This job guarantee for 6 months, it needs to pay young people well. You know, we've got a backdrop of concerns and discussions about reversing or delaying the closing of those age-tiered wage gaps. That's really scary for those young people, knowing they're going to go into these roles for 6 months and not know if they're going to be on a wage that they can actually live on. And it's important to know there is no age-based discount on rent, on food or on bills. So we really, really need to tackle that and make sure that job guarantee isn't just a guarantee of poverty for a lot of young people that have been struggling to access work for a long time. But then on top of that, there needs to be a real discussion about making sure the work is good quality work, that they're not being thrust into poor pay, that they're not working under poor conditions in poor quality work that doesn't act as a step into the career ladder that they have intended or built for themselves or are wanting to be in. The government needs to promise that not only do people have a guarantee of a job, but they have a guarantee of good working conditions and decent pay in that job. And that's really going to be concerning a lot of young people who are facing this.
Okay. Now, Amira, one other issue that's arisen today that affects the people that you represent, students, in other words. I'm sure you'll have seen this report by the Union of Jewish Students, which found that one in five university students in Britain would be reluctant to share a house with a Jewish student, according to research. And the research is warning that anti-Semitism has become normalised. One in five university students in Britain would be reluctant to share a house with a Jewish student. When you heard that this morning, what was your kind of initial reaction?
I mean, I think it's fundamentally so shocking. We're living in an environment where we're seeing the rise of anti-Semitism, the rise of racism, the rise of oppression for so many people from marginalized communities who do not feel safe on their campuses. And so, I mean, one, hearing that is absolutely shocking. But two, what it means is that we've got real work to do. As a National Union of Students, as student unions across the country, as universities across the UK, there is real work that needs to happen to tackle anti-Semitism on campuses. Reading the report this morning and also working so closely with the Union of Jewish Students this year has been a real honour. But it speaks to what is happening on campuses and what so many young Jewish students particularly are facing right now.
And what is happening on campuses? I mean, we do hear, but you know, you're at the kind of the coal face of it. What actually is happening that would make people feel comfortable admitting to this? I mean, they're being honest, but what they're being honest about is pretty awful.
I mean, what's happening on campuses is a reflection of what we're seeing happen across the UK. Our campuses must become inclusive, welcoming spaces for everyone. It is clearly time for change, and we need everyone involved in universities to be a part of this. Jewish students are currently facing a wave of anti-Semitism on campus, and we are committed to doing everything in our power to support them.
The report authors say that these figures, this survey, would suggest that anti-Semitism is becoming normalised. Do you agree with that statement?
I think what we're seeing is that the marginalisation of so many communities has become more and more normalised across the board. I think I would agree with that statement. What we're seeing is that more and more frequently, and this is across the UK, across campuses, but also across everywhere, that certain language, certain ideas, various different anti-Semitic tropes are becoming more and more normalised across campuses, across the UK, across the board. And it means that we need to take action, but it means we need to lead with education. We need to lead by putting people into that anti-Semitism awareness training. We need to lead by genuine conversations where people get experience seeing, working and having real relationships with their Jewish counterparts on campus. There is no one simple solution, but I actually think the report does a really fantastic job of going, what are the things that we can pinpoint and what are the first steps that we can take to really tackling a crisis that's been happening for higher education for a really long time?
And have you come up, do you know anyone who would feel the same way, who would be reluctant to live with a Jewish housemate? I'm not saying that you would necessarily agree with them, but have you actually come face to face with anyone like that?
I think it's hard to know whether you have. I guess to answer that question, I'm confident that I work with really fantastic people that, you know, stand against anti-Semitism, that stand against racism. And I'm really honoured to work with so many student leaders that are so passionate about delivering change on this. We are seeing a turn, that there's a positive side. I mean, working with so many Jewish student leaders who are turning around and saying, we've had enough and we're going to make a change. Right now is the time for change. I think there's also a story of hope that these stories are being told, that we're getting this data and this data is being gathered, that it's being reported on, that the CST are stepping up and doing this work that they have been doing for years. I mean, it's a really difficult environment that our Jewish students are facing and navigating. And I can only thank and be so pleased to be working alongside people that that champion work like this.
Okay, Amira, thank you very much for talking to us about both those issues. That's Amira Campbell, who's the UK president of the National Union of Students. Some of you getting in touch about the £3,000 incentive. Amy says, why are we supporting kids on benefits to get jobs with a £3,000 incentive when loads of kids have been working hard, taking on debt at university, trying their hardest to get not just graduate jobs, but Saturday or holiday jobs? It seems like rewarding the kids on benefits and not doing anything to help the kids trying. What do you think? You know how to get in touch by now. You can text on 87222. Start your message with the word Times. Or you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. Now coming up, Strava for dogs. Why? Just why? It's 2:21. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight.
I went out on the road this week with the First Lady and we rode back in the motorcade.
No fake news, no flag waving, and no Trump derangement syndrome. Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix.
Save up to 50% on kitchen units with the Spend and Save offer. And for a limited time, there's an extra 10% off. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find your nearest kitchen showroom at wix.co.uk.
Right, it is 2:23. This is Asma Mir, in case you were wondering. Some of you saying you're doing a double take. I'm just here today. I'm covering for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. They are back tomorrow. But thank you so much for all your lovely messages. We're going to talk about fitness trackers now, because are you wearing one right now? They do allow us, of course, to monitor our steps, our sleep, our exercise. But now many of us are tracking our dogs too. A boom in pet tech has led to collars that can monitor where your dog is, how far it's run, with some owners even comparing their pet's activity like it's a canine version of Strava. But is all this data actually helping our dogs, or is it just giving us another thing to track? And let's speak to Lilo Ask Henriksen, who's a holistic vet nurse who uses GPS trackers with her four chihuahuas. Hi, Lilo.
Hi, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. First of all, I think we need to, you've got four chihuahuas. What are they called? They've got great names.
Yeah, so the four of them, it's Zoe, Zia, Nomi and Neo.
Okay. I'd love to be in a park when you shout for all four of them at the same time. But anyway, yeah. Tell me, why did you decide to use one of these in the first place? What does it do for you and what does it do for the dogs?
Yeah, so for me, it's more of a peace of mind where I can feel safe in a park with the four of them running around. In case, obviously, they're small dogs. And unfortunately, in London, there is a lot of herding dogs, spaniels and greyhounds that find my dogs very fun to chase. Mm. So that's just a peace of mind for me. From a health perspective, being a holistic vet nurse, I do think it's quite good to look at how much they sleep, because sleeping is something that we very often overlook as dog parents. We forget that dogs do need a lot of sleep, often around 18 hours a day.
Wow, 18.
Yeah, 18. And gosh. Yeah, they sleep a lot. And I think a lot of dogs today are overstimulated. And with that, we can get stressed dogs, which can cause tummy upset, allergies, immune depressants, and these kind of things as well. So, work-wise, it's great to kind of have a bit of insight of how the activity level your dog has and also like sleep levels and these things. Personally, it's more for peace of mind knowing where my dog is when I'm out and about.
And so do you know how many steps your dogs, all four of them, have taken every day?
I'm honestly not tracking the steps, but I know roughly, like, because I'm normally out an hour a couple of times a day with them. So for me, it's more the times being spent out, but I should probably know the steps as well. But it doesn't really bother me because I have healthy dogs.
Now, you've said that the tracker did once help you when one of your dogs actually ran off. Just tell us what happened and how did the tracker actually help?
Yeah, it was a chaotic morning because I thought we were by ourselves in the park. Obviously, four of them off the leads. One of them was a puppy and very kind of, she's very shy. The other ones, was following me. So one of the dogs, Neo, was chased out of the park by a spaniel. So I started running after him. Zoe and Sia followed me. And after a, I don't know, 30 seconds of running, I realized Nomi was not with us. So then I had to run back for her to get her while Nia was running and running and running. He was totally off. Luckily, because of the tracker, I could go on my phone and know exactly where he was. So that was a massive help, because then I could call my neighbour who helped me get him.
Do you think that if you're a dog lover, and I love dogs, I don't currently have a dog, but I do love dogs. If you're a dog lover, then I suppose if you're a dog lover and a tech lover, this is something you're just going to do. But actually, we did fine without these, didn't we, before they were around?
Absolutely. I mean, it's more of a, it's not a must have, but it's a peace of mind, at least for me. Because on a day-to-day, do I need it? Probably not. But in those few moments of stress where you can't find your dog, it's such a good gadget to have and feel at ease, where you can actually look at it and find out exactly where your dog is. So, I mean, do you need it? Probably not. But is it helpful for me when I'm stressed and not finding my dog? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why I got it.
Fair enough. The worst case scenario, of course, is that, you know, some people who like tech and who are a bit competitive, you know, they're competitive over their own steps. They're going to get competitive about their dog's steps. I know, like, my dog's done 12,000 steps today. How many has yours done? How many has yours done?
Yeah. And I mean, that's not necessarily a healthy thing either, because if you're very competitive, you might actually overwork your dog and pushing them too far as well, just because you want to be the top in your neighborhood, for example, or knowing that your neighbor has done 10K, so you want to do 15K. But hopefully there's not that much competition within it, but it shouldn't be, at least. In the end, it's more about the wellness of the dog and being able to be free outside as well. Because if that gives you peace of mind for your dog to be off the lead, then they're great.
Is it responsible to have the dogs off the lead? A lot of people are saying it's not responsible. Presumably it depends on the park that you're in.
You know what? You should only have your dog off the lead if you have a good recall. And I would say in London parks, 90% of dog owners do not have a recall.
Right.
So ethically, you should know the rules. You should, like, saying my dog is friendly and all of these things is just not okay. You should always have a good recall. Mm. Being off the lead is a privilege, and if you don't have a good obedient dog, you should not have them off the lead, both for their own safety but also for the safety of any other dog.
Okay, well, that's answered the critics. There's quite a few people asking the question, but, you know, you've answered it. Lilo, thank you very much. Really interesting. You seem like a very sensible lady. Lilo Ask Henriksen. She is a holistic vet nurse who uses dog tracking apps. Do you use one of these? What does it actually help? How does it improve your dog's health? Or is it just that many of us are so in love with tech that when a dog tracking app comes along, we will use that not just to track the dog, but to check that it's slept enough, that it's had enough sleep, calories, etc. I don't know. I'd love to know your actual experiences of this, because I don't know anyone who has one of these, but I know it's a thing. 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can WhatsApp on 0333 003 2353. It's 2:31. Coming up, does the law need to change to stop rich people using legal action to silence reporting? First, before that, the headlines with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has said we will not be drawn into a wider war, despite pressure from President Trump for 7 countries to provide ships to clear the Strait of Hormuz. The waterway carries a fifth of the world's oil. The Prime Minister's also announced £53 million in support for households, especially in rural areas, who have no choice but to top up their tanks at a time when wholesale prices have soared. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says her party would have a different solution.
I think, given what's happening globally, we need to start drilling in the North Sea. It is completely crazy that we're leaving our oil and gas in the ground while importing it, including from countries that are digging and drilling in that same basin.
A nursery worker who sexually abused children in Bristol has been jailed for 24 years. The judge, who sentenced 30-year-old Nathan Bennett, called him an incorrigible and dangerous paedophile. A sixth form pupil and a university student have died following a meningitis outbreak in Canterbury. 11 others are reportedly seriously ill in hospital. And Chelsea Football Club have been fined nearly £11 million and given a suspended transfer ban because of historical breaches of financial rules. The offences took place under the previous ownership of Roman Abramovich and were reported by the club's new directors. They also received an immediate 9-month ban on academy transfers. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Ah, Daniel, out of all your decisions lately, choosing Avanti West Coast First Class is by far your best. Peace and space to work, and that's service. You don't have to find the coffee finds you. Oh, what's that? The smell of bacon and success, Daniel. Success.
Arrive ready with Avanti West Coast First Class. Enjoy delicious, freshly prepared food and drink and service to your seat. Some journeys belong in first class. Book direct with Avanti West Coast. Exclusions and limitations apply.
Put a tool in Aaron Gemmell's hand and he can fix just about anything. Put his business finances in front of him and he wasn't so confident. A carpenter by trade, Aaron runs checklist property maintenance. He had all the right tools for the job, but not for his numbers. Invoicing, tax, paying suppliers, it all took time he didn't have. That's where Xero came in. Xero is the ultimate small business accounting tool in Aaron's kit. It gives him full control over everything financial, all in one place. As his business has grown, Xero has been a game changer, especially with meeting the new Making Tax Digital for Income Tax rules. It doesn't just help Aaron stay compliant, it gives him better visibility and control day to day. Xero even generates smart, professional quotes and invoices, which Aaron says gives him a competitive edge. Now Xero takes care of the numbers so Aaron can get back on the tools and get the job done right for his customers. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Afternoon, it is 2:34. This is Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover today. Jane and Fee back tomorrow. And here's a face I've missed. It's John Pienaar.
Missed you. Awfully.
How are you, John?
It's good to see you, Adam.
How are you, John? Yeah, what are you? What? Since I last spoke to you, the world's gone a bit crazy.
Yeah, well, since I last saw you, the world's gone crazy in 28 different ways.
Yeah.
And backwards again. But I'm talking about the, well, around the Middle East crisis. So we knew there was going to be strain coming in the Atlantic Alliance. And we sort of would have guessed it was going to be on mainland Europe over the Russian threat to Europe. Didn't quite see this. And we've had some red flags, the argument over Greenland, you know, even that crazy-seeming talk about conflict between NATO allies over Greenland. And, of course, there's been tension over Ukraine for a good long time, but didn't quite see this happening over the Middle East, and certainly didn't expect to see President Trump do what he did over the weekend and say, send warships. This is message to allies. Send your warships to help keep the Strait of Hormuz open to tankers and shipping, or you're going to suffer, effectively, or you're going to see damage to the NATO alliance. But that is where we are. So I'm going to be looking at where the alliance is, where it may be going. Talk to, among others, Jim Kennedy. He's a former advisor to the Clintons. And also to General Sir Richard Barons, who was co-author of the British Strategic Defence Review about the British angle. And also taking in Keir Starmer, because this has got to be seen, hasn't it, as a test of Starmer, his leadership, his ability to cope. And he's got problems of his own before any of this happened. So, you know, what difference is this going to make to him and to us, to the alliance and to just about everything else?
Is he managing to? I know it's a terrible thing to say, but, you know, political crises, global crises, you know, different leaders can utilise them to their own benefit. Presumably, when he comes up against Donald Trump, who's constantly needling him and saying, you know, you've done this wrong. I asked you, you let me down, you've done it again. Yes. It's going to be very bad. Presumably, there are some people in this country who will stand up and say, well, quite right, Keir Starmer, stand up against that kind of that kind of talk.
Yeah, I was talking about the opinion polls on this just the other day, and more people are saying that than was the case not so very long ago. Yeah. And he's also got something of the wind in his sails, Starmer, on this. There's scepticism about the Middle East crisis and you know, a desire, not universal, but a broad desire for Britain to keep, you know, back from all of that. Mm. And he can sense and see that. He can read the same polls as the rest of us. And the jury is out, I think, on how it's going to play out. But we heard Starmer this morning just going straight for the button, score a few points against my opponents here at home. And he did do that. Mm. Essentially, the message was, I'm what leadership looks like now, and that isn't Fire Arjun, Kemi Badenoch, that's not what it looks like. We'll see how that plays out. I'll talk about that too, not least on the Pino and Friends after 6 o'clock with Adam Bolton and Rachel Cunliffe.
Lovely. John, we will be listening. Thank you so much. That's John Pino. He is here at 4 o'clock, of course, with Drive. Right, it's now 2:37. Dozens of MPs are urging the Prime Minister to bring forward stronger protection against so-called slaps. That stands for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. They want that to happen in the next King's Speech. Slaps are legal actions typically used by corporations to tackle critical speech through malicious use of the legal system. The call for reform comes just days after a landmark High Court decision in the case involving the journalist Dan Needle and the tax barrister Setu Kamal. A judge threw out an £8 million libel claim against Needle, describing it as oppressive and the first recognised statutory slap under the UK's existing rules. It's quite a lot to get your head around. So with me to explain what this all means is Susan Coftree, who's from the Anti-Slap Coalition. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
I think people probably understand the basic point here, which is that the big guys, the corporations, don't like certain types of critical speech. So they do stuff using the legal system. But what do they actually do? Could you give us an example?
Yeah, sure. So what you'll find is someone who's speaking out on a matter of public interest, whether that be a journalist who's writing an article about a particular topic or a private individual who's got an interest about something that's happening in their local area and they're concerned about it. Either they start sort of raising concerns privately with the company or offering a right to reply if it's journalist pre-publication. And quite often what we see in these cases is they're met with legal letters pretty much straight away rather than necessarily getting the answers to the questions they're looking for. And that process in terms of a legal back and forth before even reaching the court stage can actually take weeks, months, sometimes even years, and drain a lot of time, money, energy, resources from the person who's defending the case. And naturally, that's actually how they work. And that's how they're so successful, because a lot of people find that they're in a position where they can't continue the case and instead kind of put into a position where they either take down the information or they don't publish at all. Mm. Really because of the weight of the legal risk that they're facing. And that's just not a good situation for our society to be in, when we need information to be free-flowing, particularly about wrongdoings, so that they can be addressed.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the kind of financial cost for people who try to criticise corporations. Exactly, the High Court ruling in the case involving Dan Needle, an £8 million claim struck out, but still reportedly cost around £146,000 to defend. So clearly, not many people have that kind of money. When did this all start? Has this been going on for years and now it has an actual name, or was there a specific thing that started this?
It's definitely not a new phenomenon. The term SLAPS itself, which is a bit of an inelegant acronym, but really does say what it does, which is lawsuits against public participation, people's right to engage in public interest speech, was invented in the late 80s, early 90s in the US. The US already has in over 30 states anti-SLAP legislation. I think in the UK, it particularly became noted about 5 years ago, just before we set up the UK Anti-SLAP Coalition, which actually was very much in response to research we did at the Foreign Policy Centre that pinpointed the UK as an international leading source for these type of legal threats, particularly against journalists who uncover financial crime and corruption. And I think part of the reason why the UK is such an attractive jurisdiction is precisely because it takes so long and it costs so much money. So to defend a defamation, it's not the only claim that used, but commonly used defamation trial, to defend it to the point where you're at trial is £500,000. Wow. Even at the early stages, as you've seen with Dan's case that you've just outlined, I mean, he only went to an early hearing where fortunately the case was struck out, but that cost £146 and 6 months of Dan's life. And actually, I'd say that's quite quick compared to a lot of the cases that we monitor.
Now, these MPs are urging the Prime Minister to bring forward stronger protection. There was some anti-slap provisions in crime legislation last year. What happened to that? And why wasn't that enough?
So the provisions that Dan relied on were adopted in actually 2023 within the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act. Now, it was very positive in the sense that slaps were recognised in that law for the first time in the UK. And Dan's case now is, you know, officially recognised in a court case as the first slap. So, you know, in a sense, that is positive. There's been a recognition of the problem. However, despite the obvious kind of limitations that the case has to be linked to economic crime, there are also fundamental flaws within the mechanism, which was adopted back in 2023 and only came into force last year. What's kind of ironic about all of this is after the ECTA provisions, there was a Labour MP under the last government, Wayne David, who brought forward a private members bill that would have introduced universal anti-slap legislations, so i.e. doesn't matter what topic you know, the person is speaking about or writing about, it would have been covered. And during the progress of that bill under the last parliament, it was recognised that the ECTA mechanism was flawed and amendments were already made. Now, that private members bill was backed by the Conservative government, despite having been put forward by a Labour MP. So now we're in a situation 2 years later after the general election where there's a Labour government in place, but no legislation having been brought forward. So it's really good to see this calls from MPs, and it's always been an issue that's had cross-party support in Parliament, to really urge the government to take this opportunity in the upcoming King's Speech to really put their sort of money where their mouth is and take action.
I mean, the King's Speech, as you say, it's upcoming. It's quite soon. A government source quoted in The Times says any future action on slaps would take time to get right and they wouldn't want to legislate in haste. That would suggest that May might be too soon for you to see the stuff you want to see.
Unfortunately, I think that's a line that they have been using since they came into government.
It did sound familiar, but to be fair, I think many governments have said this before.
And so, you know, the UK used to be leading on this issue in Europe, particularly because of the ECTA provisions that we've talked about and the private members bill that was going through a couple of years ago. In the interim, the European Union has introduced an anti-slaps directive. The Council of Europe, which the UK is still part of, has introduced a recommendation a couple of years ago. There is a wealth of information and drafting that's already happened with the previous PMB. I don't understand the blockage. I mean, and clearly MPs realise, particularly because of the number of cases, and they will be contacted by their constituents who are facing this issue. Why wait? Bring forward some legislation. Let it be debated, and hopefully things could move forward and have protections for people who are being targeted in this way.
Okay, Susan, it's really interesting. Thank you very much, Susan Coftree, who's from the Anti-Slap Coalition. Let me know what you think about that. 87222. Start your message with the word time so you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. A bit of an argument has broken out really about dogs. Of course it has, and dog trackers. Some of you saying that dog trackers are ridiculous, and some of you swear by it. Caroline, dog trackers, which are smart devices, will mean that dogs will equally be affected by the condition electrosensitivity, which is estimated to affect 5% of the population. Another one here, Aggie, I can't imagine not having a tracker on my dog anymore. It is such peace of mind knowing that I can always track my dog's whereabouts. I've seen too many people pleading for help to find their dog that was lost and couldn't be found. I must say that we do not check the step count, as those monitors are not sophisticated enough yet to tell the difference between walk and a car ride. We were on the top of the table after a road trip to Scotland. Fair enough. And Jim says, I use a dog tracker to track my challenge with my two border collies to be the first team to run the equator equivalent distance of 25,000 miles together, says Jim in Somerset. Right, okay. I mean, are you for these trackers? Are you not? You know how to get in touch. The usual way is 87222. Start your message with the word at Times. Now, coming up, how is AI being weaponized in the war with Iran? We'll catch up on the day's big tech stories. At 2:46, this is Asma Mir on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Right, it is 2:48. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio. Businesses have criticised Companies House, the UK's corporate register, after it was forced to suspend its online filing service due to a data breach. Of course, a glitch actually allowed members of the public to view and edit personal details on the register, presumably not just their own. I'm not sure. Let's find out with the tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker. Afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Asma.
I mean, you know, I don't know if I'm shocked about this stuff anymore, and I think that's bad.
Yeah, we do have some ropey AI in the UK sometimes, and this is a really embarrassing issue. You're right to say that it wasn't just their own information that they could have accessed and altered. It was anybody else's, and there are 5 million or so companies listed on Companies House, big and small. And yes, this is a hugely embarrassing issue where you could have accessed pretty much anybody's information and potentially changed stuff like their email address, their contact details. You could have called yourself the CEO of Tesco for a day by just simply clicking back a few times on your browser.
How did it happen? Do we know?
Yeah, basically, we have obviously access, if you own a company in the UK, and many of our listeners probably do and probably are well versed in how Companies House works, you can access that information and then edit and file documents there in due course, as you're always meant to. And so to do that, you have access to your own company's listings. And this was identified by a white hat hacker. This is one of those people who goes around probing and testing for these sorts of issues, but doesn't then do anything nefarious with them. They just report it. And basically what they found is that if you log in to a Companies House account, you then log into your own. You then press the back button a few times and something goes wrong in terms of the system that underpins it. And actually, therefore, you can change the company that you're editing the details of to do whatever you want.
Is this the kind of, I mean, there's been many data breaches over the years and we just have to kind of swallow it. That's what we're told, aren't we? It's like, you know, your details are all, they're all out there now. So tough. Change your passwords and hope for the best. Is this the shape of things to come?
It is. As more and more things become digitised, I think, unfortunately, we are going to encounter this sort of thing more frequently. I mean, it's worth pointing out, as you know, Companies House say that this wasn't necessarily a data breach. They point out that passwords in this instance weren't compromised, that actually some of the stuff that you do upload as part of a regular registration on Companies House, that can include your passport, your ID cards, whatever it is that you have, they weren't also breached. And they did say, however, that this has been going on a long time. They first identified this as being an issue now, having looked back in October 2025. And the CEO of Companies House, Andy King, he's put out a statement this morning saying that he recognises this incident will have caused concern and inconvenience to many of the companies and individuals who rely on their services. And he's really sorry for that. Reality is, I think that this sort of thing, while a particularly kind of basic issue here, is going to happen more often. So try, as we always say in this segment at this time of the programme, to keep your passwords separate, not reuse them. Make sure you have a firewall in some way between each of your bank accounts and things like that that you use online, because one key to the kingdom can be really damaging.
Certainly can. Now, the writing tool Grammarly has removed an AI feature which apparently mimicked famous writers. I mean, again, I was about to say, how could it do that? But, you know, AI can do many things. Just explain, if this is not your world, how did it do it?
Yeah, many of our listeners probably will know of Grammarly for either their children or their grandchildren, perhaps using it through schoolwork. It's kind of a fancy autocorrect. It's a bit of a souped-up version of that, where it will go through, identify any dangling modifiers, confusion between your singulars and plurals, and misplaced commas, so on and so forth. But they've introduced in recent weeks this new feature, which is designed not just to teach the basics of grammar and to tidy up some of those errors that you might have made along the way in your documents, but to actually give you more substantial editing advice. So you could, for instance, have Stephen King giving you feedback, or an AI facsimile of it.
Why would you want that, though? I don't understand.
Well, I guess it's that if you're a budding sci-fi writer, or, you know, someone who is, perhaps you want to try and learn from the best. And, you know, Stephen King, I think, is probably going to be unable to help you with that and sit by your side and give you advice on where to put a verb and so on. So effectively what Grammarly has done here is they have tried to monetize without permission, and this is the key issue, the writings, the beliefs, what they think an individual author or an editor or something like that may do based on the training data that these AI models are working from. And this is the fundamental issue that we always talk about when we talk about AI, is the training data, the information on which they come up with their answers, their responses to us, is always in a little bit of a grey area in terms of how that was obtained. And so here what Grammarly is doing is they are using the patterns of writing and grammar that many of these leading authors and also a good number of journalists would have, and saying, well, if you were to be edited by Stephen King or Carl Sagan or someone like that, then this is what they might say. But the problem is they didn't ask people.
Yeah, that's quite a big problem. It's interesting. I mean, if we stand back for a minute, because, you know, you'll be able to give us a bigger picture here. And this is a really basic question. Why does AI sometimes bypass consent?
How do I answer that while being on a live radio programme and knowing media law in the UK? There are always some significant challenges. There are always some significant challenges around this. You know, we know that AI models are trained on what is called the common crawl. That is the commonly used training data for this sort of thing. That is a massive sweep of the web. There is no suggestion here, by the way, that these companies that are running these AI models are using these sorts of data, but those data do exist on the web. So, you know, not them, but other people will pirate books, for instance, and upload them onto the internet. And unfortunately, sometimes that can be subsumed into various bits of training data. What is interesting about this is, at least one person has said that they really don't like the idea of what is happening here with Grammarly. So Julia Angren, who's a New York Times opinion writer, is lodging a lawsuit against the company behind Grammarly, Superhuman, saying that actually, you know, she didn't ask for this. She was absolutely stunned to find that this was out there, and that she doesn't believe that it's right, and it's a bit of a violation.
Mm. Well, finally, sticking with AI, Donald Trump has accused Iran of using AI to spread disinformation and misrepresent its successes. How's it doing that?
Basically by producing content that may or may not represent what is going on the ground in the Middle East. And we've seen on our social media feeds and also on Times Radio and many other places discussion around influencers and some of the horrific videos that we're seeing of missiles and drones hitting various places around the region. Not all of those are necessarily valid or correct. Those that are, you know, end up on TV by professional journalists, of course, are. They are vetted and checked and ensured that they're correct. But a lot of the stuff that you see on social media isn't. And Donald Trump here is claiming, with some evidence, by the way, in this instance, that Iran is seeding misinformation propaganda, effectively, to try and amp up its offensive powers and also to try and tamp down its defensive issues that it is having. So Trump here is saying basically that the media is being complicit in sharing this. I don't think that's necessarily quite correct, but certainly there was also a New York Times investigation that found more than 110 different videos purporting to be from Iran that were entirely AI generated. The problem here, of course, Azma, is if you are a mischief maker, you have very easy access to these sorts of tools, and you can create incredibly lifelike videos and images that can frankly fool someone if they're halfway around the world.
And I'm not saying it's the same thing, but Donald Trump is not a he's someone who has embraced certain AI videos that have graced the internet himself.
Yeah, we had the infamous video of the Gaza Riviera. We also had him dropping effluent from a plane flying over a US city. Donald Trump is very boomer-coded, I think, as the kids would say, which is, he's a man of a certain age who probably spends a little bit too much time on social media. He really enjoys the whiz-bang technology that is available to him, and so he likes to share these sorts of things, perhaps without thinking about what the consequences might well be.
Chris, thank you very much for that. That is Chris Stokoe Walker. He is a tech journalist, of course. Remember, you can get in touch as well, 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. The thing that's got you going the most is definitely the dog trackers. Dale, we have two dogs and had a tracker for them when they were puppies. It was only to locate them in case they escaped from the garden while we were having building work done. Builders aren't always great at closing gates. Once they were older and fully trained, we gave up the trackers. Call, leave the expletive deleted phone in your pocket and just enjoy walking your dog. This is just an excuse to use a phone. If your dog is on the other end of a lead, you know where it is without resorting to fancy tech. That one comes from Tom. And my lab has one, as he's been known to track deer. Gosh, fascinating to watch how he follows his own trail through the woods back to me. Nowadays, though, the dog doesn't need it, but my wife does use it vicariously to track me on walks. I knew someone was going to come up with that. Thank you very much for that, Will. Remember, if you want to get in touch with anything you hear on the programme, I am here until 4 o'clock. Then it's John Pienaar. Of course, you know how to get in touch. You can email as well. studio@times.radio, the WhatsApp number 0333 003 2353, or text 87222 and start your message with the word Times. It's coming up to 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 3 o'clock. You're listening to Asma Mir on Times Radio. Still to come, what is the humanitarian impact of the Iran conflict? We'll get the latest from the streets of Beirut with Gabriel Carlson from the Red Cross. We'll also hear from Richard Mead, who's from Lloyd's List, on what oil tankers stuck in the Persian Gulf could mean for global energy supplies and why you should care. And after 3:30, the money man, Adam Shaw, will be here to explain what the current war will mean for air travel. First, the latest news, Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. Keir Starmer says it's not a simple task to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, but he's working with allies on a viable plan. It's after Donald Trump said it would be very bad for the future of NATO if allies don't help secure the critical waterway for global oil shipping. The PM insists the UK won't be drawn into the wider conflict. The Times' Whitehall editor Ben Clatworthy says the Prime Minister's emphasis on an allied coalition response to the war is similar to his approach to the conflict in Ukraine.
In the press conference, there was a whole section in his speech on how political rivals would have got involved in the war at the start, and then 7 days later have realised that it was a bad decision, and that as Prime Minister, that's not something you can do. You cannot join a war and then leave it. He is saying that his decision has been vindicated and that this is the best approach to take still.
A nursery worker has been sentenced to 24 years in jail and a further 6 on licence for sexually abusing toddlers in his care in Bristol. Nathan Bennett from near Bath was first reported when staff reviewed CCTV. The 30-year-old's victims were aged 2 and 3. This man sent 2 children there and is horrified remembering updates he'd receive. An actor's voiced his words.
Going back and seeing messages from Nathan saying he's changed their nappy, applied nappy cream, it's things like that that... Now seeing it through a whole new perspective, it just makes you feel sick to think there's been anywhere near her.
Elsewhere, senior Labour sources have described it as a shameful use of money that party funds were used to cover the cost of a specialist tax lawyer hired to look into Angela Rayner's finances. It was prior to her resignation as Deputy Prime Minister last year. Jonathan Peacock, KC, spent up to 5 days examining Rayner's finances, providing a draft and final legal advice about the purchase of a £700,000 flat in Hove. The UK's president of the National Union of Students has told Times Radio Jewish students are facing a shocking wave of anti-Semitism across university campuses. A report by the Union of Jewish Students suggests that 1 in 5 students are reluctant to live with Jewish housemates. Here's President Amira Campbell.
We're living in an environment where we're seeing the rise of anti-Semitism, the rise of racism, the rise of oppression for so many people from marginalised communities who do not feel safe on their campuses. One, hearing that is absolutely shocking. But two, what it means is that we've got real work to do. As a National Union of Students, as student unions across the country, as universities across the UK, there is real work that needs to happen to tackle anti-Semitism.
More than 30,000 people in Canterbury are being contacted by the UK Health Security Agency about a meningitis outbreak. A student and a year 13 school pupil have died, and 11 people are seriously ill in hospital. And researchers at the University of Edinburgh used a specially engineered bacteria to convert plastic water bottles into a gold standard treatment for managing the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Researchers say it's the first time plastic waste is being turned into a medicine for a neurological disorder. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms.
Good afternoon to you. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio, standing in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. They are back tomorrow. It is 3:04. Lovely to have you with me until 4 o'clock. And then it's John Pienaar, of course, with Drive. Now, Keir Starmer says that Britain will not be dragged into the war in the Middle East, despite a request from Donald Trump.
We have been clear and consistent in our objectives throughout this conflict. First, we will protect our people in the region. Second, while taking the necessary action to defend ourselves and our allies, we will not be drawn into the wider war. And third, we will keep working towards a swift resolution that brings security and stability back to the region and stops the Iranian threat to its neighbours.
That was Keir Starmer speaking this morning. Now, fighting continues in the Middle East, with Israel saying it still has thousands of targets to hit in Iran. Flights at Dubai Airport were suspended this morning after an Iranian drone hit a fuel depot. Iran says more than 1,200 civilians have been killed by US and Israeli airstrikes, with reports of more than 700 people dying in Lebanon too. Gabriel Carlson is the British Red Cross regional representative for the Middle East and North Africa, and we can speak to him now. Good afternoon to you, Gabriel.
Good afternoon.
You're in Beirut. 700 people reported to have died in Lebanon. Is that what you're hearing?
That's correct. Unfortunately, we don't have the final numbers from the Minister of Health here, but I can confirm that the Lebanese Red Cross have been responding since day one for thousands of calls for evacuation, life-saving activities, and supporting communities who are told to evacuate at a heartbeat, leaving livelihoods, memories, houses they don't know if they're going to see again. We are looking at a region of about 4 million people being displaced all of a sudden. About 1 million in Lebanon, probably 1 million in Iran, and 2 million in Gaza. And that is in the Middle East only, where we know that we are keeping track on. However, at the same time, the Red Cross continues to respond across all those places, from Gaza through Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, across the border to Lebanon, Iraq and Jordan, the Gulf and in Iran. That's the uniqueness of the Red Cross.
And forgive the question, but I'm trying to get a kind of picture of how this is different to other airstrikes. Where are the people who are dying? Where are they? Are they dying in their homes? Are they dying in their homes because America or Israel, whoever says that that there's a Hezbollah target near to where they're living? Where is this happening?
The Red Cross, when we respond to the calls for life-saving missions, we don't ask what are these people, or what's their backgrounds. What we have seen, that schools have been targeted, medical facilities have been targeted, hospitals. We have seen civilian infrastructure being targeted across the region. What we have seen at these casualties, they are people who probably could not leave their houses, even though they were told so, because they don't have the means to leave. They're elderly, or they have special needs, or they don't believe that the life of displacement, the hardship of displacement, is something that they want to go through again. So that's why across the region, we have the civilians paying the highest toll of this armed conflict.
And the people who do leave, I mean, again, you say they're being asked to leave in a heartbeat. The people who do leave, where are they going?
Unfortunately, there are not enough shelters to provide to everybody leaving. We see outside the building I'm at that families, children, elderly, sleeping on the sidewalk in very tough weather conditions. Shelter is full, no matter how much the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement teams are responding. The needs are bigger than one organization, even though this is our bread and butter for the last 150 years, responding to man-made and natural catastrophes and crises. What we are seeing across the Middle East today, in Israel, in Palestine, in Lebanon and in Iran, is beyond any one organization to respond to.
And what is the situation, as far as you are able to know, for civilians inside Iran?
My colleagues at the Iranian Red Crescent are responding 24/7 since the beginning of this armed conflict. They have unfortunately paid the highest price. One of my colleagues, Hamid Reza, he died in line of duty 2 days ago while responding to the needs of the civilian population, exactly like what happened in the south of Lebanon 3 days ago, when my colleague Yusuf Azaf, also a volunteer, lost his life in the south of Lebanon while responding to a life-saving mission. In the end of the day, we have our mission, we have our doctrine, we are there to save lives, we are there for the weakest, but we are also protected by international humanitarian law, which seems to be taken as a luxury, a courtesy, or a request by parties to this conflict. But we need to remind them here and now that it's not a courtesy, it's not a request on our behalf, it's an obligation. Humanitarian workers, their lives should be protected always.
And what about, Gabriel, communications? Because, for example, news organizations say they're losing touch with their sources in Iran, that Starlink terminals are being shut down or their users arrested. How able to track what is going on and where is safe and where is not are you?
For us, our contact with the colleagues of the Iranian Red Crescent is continuous. We are more or less in daily contacts with them through the International Committee of the Red Cross and through the International Federation. So for us, we have been able to secure communication lines to the leadership of the Iranian Red Crescent. And the information I shared with you about the response of the Iranian Red Crescent, about the unfortunate events of the loss of life we have suffered in Iran, came through those channels of communication.
What would help at this point? I know this is a difficult, and it's a bigger picture, it's a bigger question, but what is there something, one thing that would slightly ease this situation for civilians as far as they're concerned? Would it be, it's a ridiculous thing to say, but we are where we are. Would this be longer periods of notice before strikes are, before strikes happen? What would help here?
Thank you for asking such a good question. Conducting warfare is not illegal. What we are asking is just to adhere to the law that we have created. The international community came together and put together international humanitarian law. There are rules and regulations regulating warfare. What we are asking is for those to be respected, upheld, and those who breach them, they should be held responsible. So we can feel protected while we carry on the life-saving mission and the medical mission we are assigned by the international community. Again, for us, according to the Geneva Conventions, for us to protect life, save lives, and protect the dignity of those in need. Now, while doing that, while remind the parties, which we do through your channel, supporting the British Red Cross or supporting the Red Cross and Red Crescent, because we are on the ground, we never leave. My colleagues are from the south of Lebanon. They are from Tehran. They are from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. They are embedded. They are not foreign workers. They are not aid workers come and go. They are volunteers from the communities. And what we can do for them is to provide them with the protection they need through the respect of the emblem and provide them with the needs they have, if it's helmets, if it's first aid kits, if it's the equipment they need to use while they're out on a search and rescue mission. So that is the role we do, and we are doing everything we can at the British Red Cross to make the most of our resources available for our partners here.
Gabriel, thank you for talking to us. Gabriel Carlson is a British Red Cross regional representative for the Middle East and North Africa. Now, Keir Starmer said that he's working with European leaders on a plan to reopen the vital Strait of Hormuz, which borders Iran. In peacetime, a fifth of the world's oil passes through that waterway. A little earlier, I spoke to Richard Mead. He's editor-in-chief of the shipping news publication Lloyd's List, and I asked him what was happening right now in the Strait of Hormuz.
We are still in a situation where, by and large, ships are not moving through the Strait of Hormuz. That's not a blanket statement, because there are some, and I think it's been described as a complete closure. That's not true. We have seen some ships moving in and out, but the majority up until this weekend had been what we describe as shadow fleet ships. So half of all transits going through since the conflict began were essentially Iranian exports, and obviously Iran is not attacking its own ships, and Iran had been exporting at roughly the same level that it had been prior to the conflict. Meanwhile, everybody else was either already locked into the Gulf and unable to exit due to security concerns, or waiting in ballast, empty, outside in the Gulf of Oman, waiting to get in. And that had held until the last round of direct ship attacks. And we saw a number attacked just before the weekend. We're now up to 16 ships that have been hit by missiles since the beginning of the conflict. And what we saw after the last wave was a few ships trying to get out before the next wave of attacks. So there's a lot of different risk calculations that are going on, and we're hearing lots of political noises from the Indian government trying to negotiate directly with Tehran. We think similar conversations are happening with China to try and get passage for Chinese and Indian ships to go through. But right now, very limited movement.
We have heard in the last couple of hours that a non-Iranian tanker has made the transit for the first time. It's the Aframax tanker Karachi, which is carrying Abu Dhabi's Das crude. Are you aware of that?
We are still looking at the details behind the latest movements, but I think what we have seen after the last wave of attacks was a handful of ships basically making the strategic decision to get out while they could. And these attacks tend to happen in waves. And I think the fact that they all happened after the last wave finished almost immediately suggests that the calculation is that they can move out. But that's a risky calculation. So we saw last week, at the tail end of the week, a Thai-flagged, Thai-owned ship. And I know, because I spoke to the ship owners behind it, that they had been advised and calculated that because they were Thai, they were lower risk. Their ship got hit. Three seafarers were locked inside the engine room as the ship burned. So this is not a This is not a binary risk calculation. You can't assume that just because, you know, it is not directly affiliated with Israel or the US or their allies that you are necessarily going to have free passage through the strait right now.
What does your industry make of, or the shipping industry as well, make of Donald Trump's idea for this multinational coalition to protect tankers? He says he's talking to, quote, about seven countries.
Yes, and I think we saw that announcement raised initially in the, you know, direct aftermath of the first round of attacks, and I think it was received with some skepticism from the industry. I think now we are here, there is an acceptance that there is going to need to be some sort of naval protection. But I think it comes with the caveat that even if you had a coalition force escort situation in place, it doesn't resolve the problem. Mm. This is a very narrow waterway. Now, normally, you are speaking about 20% of global energy exports coming through this very small passage. Now, if you were doing that on a convoy basis with naval escorts, hypothetically, you apply, say, 8 to 10 destroyers. They would only realistically be able to do convoys of between 5 to 10 commercial ships at one point. And you would only have that one way because it's too narrow to do both ways at the same time. Realistically, you're looking at a best case scenario of between 8 to 10% of normal flows if there is all of the convoy sort of assets provided that we would need. And that's not a guarantee. So I think, you know, there's a lot of calculations. I don't think it's necessarily going to happen quickly. I don't think it's necessarily going to get the trade flows back up to where we would need them to be to not affect oil price, but it will get some ships out.
And finally, Richard, presumably the only way that this is going to be resolved is if Iran and America reach some kind of deal.
I think that's right. And to the point that, you know, supply chains are vulnerable, I think the general public had sort of got a bit of a wake-up call during the COVID pandemic, and, you know, events like, you know, large ships getting stuck in the Suez Canal for a week have revealed quite how fragile supply chains are and what the impact is beyond the immediate local blockages. But it's not just oil. It's about containerized goods. It's about dry bulk. Food prices are affected by grain not being able to move around. These things have consequences. Supply chains are fragile and they have global implications. I think you're right. You know, you don't see this quickly resolving unless there is a political solution. You can have some security imposed, but as I say, it doesn't resolve the problem at the capacity you need it to be at to not be a problem. You know, the oil price is not going to come down just because naval escorts are in place, because you still only have a fraction of the oil moving that you would otherwise need.
That was Richard Mead, the editor-in-chief of Lloyd's List. It gives you something to chew on, really, an impossible situation, really. And what Donald Trump is calling for won't necessarily unblock the Strait of Hormuz to the level that people need and want it to be. Coming up, here's a question for you. What were you doing at the age of 16, probably not scoring in the Premier League? Vassos Alexander is going to talk to us about Arsenal's youngest ever goal scorer. It is 3:19. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Ryan Tubridy on Times Radio.
Join me, Ryan Tubridy, every Sunday afternoon right here on Times Radio. I'll be bringing you the best of the Sunday Times, from news to literature to pop culture. We'll have all the big brains on my news panel, plenty of books to get stuck into, and the occasional celebrity appearance too. So join me every Sunday afternoon on Times Radio.
Ryan Tubridy starts this Sunday from 1 on Times Radio.
When you leave a gift in your will to guide dogs, where could it lead? It might lead to someone getting their first guide dog, like David.
I withdrew from everything. I could no longer do the things that really brought me joy. He put that smile back on my face.
Your gift to guide dogs could lead to a future where lives are transformed. Find out how to make your life-changing will for free. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs.
Meet iPhone 17e. A whole lot for a lot less. With an almighty all-powerful A19 chip and Ceramic Shield 2, built to survive this and this. And a 48-megapixel fusion camera with 2x optical quality zoom and next-gen portraits. And double the starting storage of iPhone 16e. Huh. And long-lasting battery life for hours and hours of streaming. And you can charge it with USB-C or with MagSafe accessories. Ooh. And a whole lot more. All for a lot less. Get the new iPhone 17e today. Ceramic Shield 2 on front display. Battery life varies by use. Accessories sold separately. Price compared to iPhone 17 at apple.com/UK.
The Story.
The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wix.co.uk.
Well, hello there. 3:21. This is Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. And every week on this show, you know that you're going to hear fantastic interviews, brilliant guests. And you, if you miss it, fear not. You can listen to it on the podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee, which drops at around 6 p.m. You can hear all of their 3:30 interviews in full, including Nancy Birtwistle, Zach Goldsmith and Jenny Godfrey. And last week they spoke to Peter Hammond and Ash Smith, campaigners against sewage pollution, who were recently portrayed in Channel 4's Dirty Business. Today, the Times revealed that there were 15,000 illegal sewage spills, 15,000 flowing into rivers and the sea last year. While raw sewage discharges are legally permitted due to heavy rainfall, many of these spills came on days of, you guessed it, no rain, deemed illegal by the Environment Agency. Peter told Fee that he thinks the Environment Agency doesn't really have a clue what's going on.
Well, obviously, the Environment Agency's job is to police the activities of the water companies, you know, in terms of guarding against abuse of, and pollution of rivers. But what we found very quickly was that although there was very detailed data available, they were just asking for summary data, which you couldn't possibly use to evaluate what was going on. So we immediately went straight for this detailed data, which just revealed thousands of illegal sewage spills. And I remember when I had to give evidence to the Environmental Audit Committee in the House of Commons, I stuck my neck out and said, I think it's 10 times worse than the agency know about. And then later I had to revise that. I got it wrong. I told them it's 20 times worse. So actually, you know, they didn't really have a clue about what was going on.
You can download that and many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcast from, of course. Right, it is 3:23 now. You're listening to Times Radio. Some news from today regarding Chelsea, who've been given a suspended one-year transfer ban and fined more than £10 million in relation to historical breaches of Premier League rules. Vassos Alexander is here to talk us through all the sports news. Hi, Vassos.
Hello, Asma.
How big a deal is this? £10 million?
Well, it's the biggest fine that the Premier League have ever given out. Actually double what the previous biggest was. £5.5 million West Ham were given in 2007 over the Tevez and Mascherano and the third party ownership. But the Premier League say it would have been double that. It would have been £20 million if Chelsea hadn't basically put their hands up and said, this is our fault. This happened over the previous regime. Todd Bowley took over in 2022, had a look at the books and said, hang on, there's these £47 million in secret payments that the Premier League have described as for the benefit of Chelsea. It's to unregistered agents and third parties over transfers between those years, 2011 and 2018. So it is a big deal, but it's a suspended transfer ban. It's a big old fine, but you sort of get the feeling that Chelsea can afford that. And they also have an academy transfer ban for the next 9 months. So it's a big-ish deal, but it was largely expected when Todd Bowley said that this had been going on. It sort of reminds you, doesn't it, of a government taking over and said, all of this was happening over our predecessors, nothing to do with us.
Yeah. I still don't quite understand about the payments, though. The payments were just, they were correct, but who were they to and what was wrong with them?
So, you know, when you go through a transfer, you have to have a registered agent. You have to, you know, you have to go through, you have to dot the I's and cross the T's and, you know, and it's pretty complicated. The fact is, so the Premier League say it did benefit Chelsea to make these payments. So it just feels a little bit grubby. It feels a little bit underhand as far as I understand it. But crucially, the Premier League say that Chelsea would have still, even if they announced this £47 million in the secret payments, they would have still passed all the sort of financial fair play rules. So a points deduction doesn't come into effect.
Now, the Premier League has a new youngest ever goal scorer. I know that Piers Morgan was getting very excited about this. Aged 16 years and 73 days, this is Arsenal's Max Dowman, who's made history at the weekend.
I I mean, everyone's getting pretty excited about Max Dowman. So he had a couple of appearances in the League Cup. And then, I mean, he was still 15 at the time. And then he was injured for a few months. And then Arsenal, we were talking to Jane and Fee about this a couple of weeks ago. They're not set to be the most popular Premier League winners. I mean, this sort of constipated march towards this first title in 22 years. And the football's not been great and the gamesmanship. And then suddenly they're on their way to a turgid draw with Everton at the weekend, and the Emirates once again is just this place of real fear and clenched teeth. And then suddenly Max Dowman, just past his 16th birthday, appears on the touchline, and there's a lovely, lovely piece by Martin Samuel this morning in the Times Online. As Max Dowman waits to enter the pitch on Saturday, when we see what may well be the last moments of relative normalcy for this extraordinary young man.
Yeah.
He shuffles from one foot to the other, wipes his nose on his cuff, touches his heart beating beneath the Arsenal crest, and it begins the rest of his life, a life which, if we know what we think we know, will see him acclaimed as one of the finest footballers of his generation at worst. And that's how it felt. This wonderful, just the playing football like it's like the opposite of what Arsenal have been for the rest of this season. Just this young man playing football like it was meant to be played. He created the first goal and scored the second, running the length of the pitch after Jordan Pickford had gone up for a corner to try and equalise. So he had an open goal. And there was just this glorious moment for 10, 15 seconds before he scored the goal. We knew he was going to score the goal. And it was just, you couldn't help but have a huge smile on your face, even knowing that this was unpopular Arsenal who were sort of grinding their way to the league.
Oh, dear. We have to go back to Chelsea, actually, because they had a strange encounter with a referee just before their 1-0 home loss to Newcastle.
Yes, Chelsea. This is absolutely, this is extraordinary. I saw a picture of this. My son sent me a still of Chelsea, and they have taken in recent matches to having a little huddle around the centre spot, around the ball. Yeah. And it's sort of slightly annoyed opposition, and they say it's nothing to do with the opposition. We don't want to annoy anyone. It's about, quotes, this is from their manager, respecting the ball, whatever on earth that means. Anyway, come on. This is like football eating itself.
Masters, what's happened to you? What's that? You're very cynical. What's happened to you?
Well, I mean, come on, Asma. Let's respect the ball. So let's have a little huddle around the ball before kick. I mean, I suppose whatever, you know, whatever takes your fancy. But Newcastle were due to kick off. So Kieran Tierney, the referee on the day, said, look, I'm not happy with this because you're not going to just surround the ball. Newcastle are about to kick off with it. So I'm going to stand there. And so they just did their huddle around him. And it just did look ludicrous. And there's a very funny piece again in the Times Online today talking about the ring of fire, which is what the Australian men's
yes.
close field cricketers were dubbed in the early 2000s, a sort of fearsome ring there. And it says less ring of fire and more ring of roses. and Liam Rastinia, the Chelsea manager, who tried to be furious with the referee. We're looking at the comments online on the Times, on the BBC Sport website, and almost to a woman and man, everyone's going, Liam Rossini, what are you talking about? How can you possibly put this on the referee?
It's all mind games. I think I might hover at the end of this programme, just hover over John Pienaar, so you see how he likes it. Vassos, thank you very much.
Thanks,
that was the sports journalist Vassos Alexander. He will be with us every day at this time. And if you want more on that story, of course, you can go to thetimes.com. I can read the article by Martin Samuel or all the other wonderful sports pieces that you get in the Times and head to the sports section, of course. Right. Coming up, I'm going to get some book recommendations from the Times literary editor. What a fantastic afternoon this is turning out to be. It's 3:30. Before that, we're going to get a check on the latest news headlines with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister insists the UK won't be dragged into a wider war in the Middle East. Sir Keir Starmer says his priority is to protect British nationals in the region and to work towards a swift resolution that brings security and stability. He's also laid out plans to provide £53 million to households that use heat oil and are affected by spiking costs. A year 13 pupil and a university student have died after an outbreak of a rare form of invasive meningitis in the Canterbury area. 11 others are reportedly seriously ill in hospital. Hundreds of students at the University of Kent have been queuing for antibiotics at the campus, and more than 30,000 people in the area are being contacted by UK Health Security Agency. Dr. Dom Nutt from Meningitis Now and says there are some symptoms to be on the lookout for.
Things like an aversion to bright lights, a stiff neck. In some, but very much not all cases, there may be a rash on the skin that doesn't disappear when pressure is applied to it. What you're really looking out for is someone who's unwell and deteriorating. And in those cases, we'd recommend seeking urgent medical help.
Three people have been arrested after a man's body was found in a wheelie bin in Coventry. West Midlands police say two men and a woman were detained overnight in Blackpool. A mother's appeared in court charged with murdering her 18-day-old baby daughter who fell from a residential property in Westminster over the weekend. The woman, who's 43, was not asked to enter a plea. And Chelsea have been hit with an £11 million fine by the Premier League over unregistered payments to agents and other individuals. The payments were self-reported by the owners, but took place under the previous ownership under Roman Abramovich. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio. This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wickes. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wickes.co.uk.
Right, it's time to draw back the curtain on our literary salon. Robbie Millen, the literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, joins me now. Good afternoon to you.
Hello there.
Just very, very quickly, Robbie, earlier on we were talking to the tech journalist Chris Stalker-Walker about the writing tool Grammarly, having to remove an AI feature because it mimicked famous writers. So if you wanted Stephen King to edit your work, you could, but obviously they forgot to get consent.
It's funny that, isn't it? When there's billions at stake, how they often forget
to ask. It's so strange, isn't it? I mean, is this kind of something you're getting used to? Is this something that authors are very annoyed about? Or are they just, I really don't know how to kind of react to it.
I think it's fury.
Fury.
At the end of last year, there was this big court case in the States with, I think it was Anthropic. And I think they sort of decided on an out-of-court settlement. They would say they would give $1.5 billion to authors whose work had been pirated. Mm. And essentially, they're kind of their LLMs, their AIs crawled all over to sort of suck out the meaning and knowledge.
Yeah.
I don't think any payments have been made yet. I think a judge needs to decide is $1.5 billion enough. But it's like, for them, I think it's, for these big tech companies, it's worth moving fast, breaking things, just taking stuff. And because the prizes are so big, who cares about boring things like copyright?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's clearly something that's going to have to, I don't know, we have to get our heads around. Who knows what's going to happen? Do you think this is something that will be able to coexist, AI and books, in a nice kind of orderly way in the next 5-10 years, or is it going to take longer?
I think it will probably, if you go on Amazon, other bookstores available, but in particular things like digital books, you'll find that there's already a lot of AI slop out there. So I think people are already, often unwittingly, buying absolute guff.
I know. I don't want to big myself up too much. Someone AI slopped my book.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly
Why would you want to do that?
Well, rather weird. I was just looking at books about Jacob Elordi, and there's hundreds of Jacob Elordi books.
Oh, I might read that. Okay, let's move on now. Come on. We're going to get on to what you've been reading. You've been making your way through the Cazalet Chronicles. Confusion is the third volume.
That's right. Now, when I usually come on and tell Fee and Jane that I'm sort of making my stately way through all five volumes of this, they kind of groan slightly. So I thought, while they're away, I can mention I just finished...
But I also think you're a show-off.
But we just finished volume three, and it's anyone who's not read them, it's a terrific sequence of five novels written from in the 90s about a sort of posh English family, and it's kind of takes us from the end of just before the Second World War up into the 1950s, early 60s, and volume three, you're right in the war years. And at first, I was thinking, oh my goodness, this is the first volume I've not liked, because a lot of the characters seem to be in the wrong place, spread apart by war. But Elizabeth Jane Howard, who wrote these five novels, brings it together. And by the end, I was blubbing like a baby.
Oh, lovely. That's a mark of a good book.
Oh, gosh, you know, definitely. It? I mean, she manages to make the placing of two glasses of whiskey and some water into something really profoundly kind of moving.
What was it that drew you to Elizabeth Jane Howard? Was it just that it's one of those things that you have to have read?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, a lot of my colleagues told me, why haven't you read this?
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
What is wrong? Am I a sexist pig? No, I can't be. I'm reading it. But I tell you what it is. Sometimes there's a sort of trend in contemporary fiction where everything's sort of rather sort of downplayed, and it's kind of slightly depressed people living alone in dead-end jobs. It's all sort of slightly downbeat, whereas it's really lovely to have these kind of five chunky novels, most of them about 500 pages long, where you can really immerse yourself.
Yeah.
Plenty of characters, all sorts of emotions. There are affairs, babies are born, there are funerals, all human life is stuffed into them.
And that sounds like my kind of thing.
Exactly.
I have to say, I think you've convinced me.
And she was such a wise old bird, Elizabeth Jane Howard.
Elizabeth Jane Howard's niece, Louisa Young,
That's
is going
right.
to be continuing this series.
That's right. So I can't remember, I think it's in the autumn. She's written a continuation novel, which I think takes the story further into the 60s. Mm. So I kind of want to finish the five original.
Yeah.
And see how she does it. Now, normally, I sort of think with continuation novels, oh, get your own idea. But with this, I'm actually quite intrigued to see whether she can pull it off. Yeah. I would definitely be reading it.
Next, you've been reading Jan Morris, A Life by Sarah Wheeler.
That's right.
An authorised biography of the legendary writer Jan Morris.
Yeah, you'll remember Jan Morris. She sort of died about 2020, at the age of 94. Probably most famous for her travel books, but also... she was probably the most famous person in the country who transitioned.
Yep.
So she started off life as James Morris, climbed Everest for the Times, brought the news to us, covered things like the Suez War as James Morris, started writing some very good history books and travel logs. And then in the late 60s, she started to sort of present herself wearing women's clothing and such lives before having what used to be called a sex change operation, Casablanca, in the early 70s, and then wrote a famous book about it, Conundrum, which came out in 1974. So she's kind of a remarkable woman, but in a way she's quite a difficult character, because I think you just get the impression, what a massive narcissist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, funny enough, a few years ago when I read Conundrum, sort of, I read it the first time about 30 years ago, my goodness, I found it deeply moving and affecting, because, you know, it was talking about a minority group we still didn't know very much about. I thought, how brave. And then I sort of reread it a few years ago, and things like, hang about, what about his family? So things like his wife and children don't get a look in, and it's obviously profoundly affected them, because he transitioned, James became Jan, in their late 40s. So he was kind of an established, you know, father with, I think, three children, a wife. So he had to divorce his wife. So it's still a really interesting character, and I adored the books.
Yeah.
Such sort of lush writing, you know. I always wondered, when I grow up, I want to write like her. She got such swagger and style and elan and brilliant at describing things.
Yeah, she's very much someone that I grew up knowing about, but not being... maybe at that point not being old enough to read it at the time.
Yes,
very much so. Finally, Metropolis by Philip Kerr. Tell us about that.
Okay, this is another slightly older book. And the reason why I thought I'd better read this is that Apple TV, a TV station that makes, among other things, Slow Horses.
Oh, yes.
They're obviously after something that sort of fits the same kind of vibe. So they're going to create a series later on in the year called Berlin Noir with Jack Loudon in it. I think he's going to play the main character, Bernie Gunter, who appears in this sequence of 14 novels. So Philip Kerr, he died very young, in his early 60s, in 2018, leaving these wonderful novels behind, starring Bernie Gunter, who's a detective in the murder Berlin murder squad. So Metropolis, which is the last one, but chronologically the first, is set in 1928. So you've got a wonderful setting of Weimar Berlin, all the decadence and sleaze and jazz bars. But the novels sort of go through the 1930s with the rise of the Nazis into the wartime. So it's how do you become a policeman, or how do you operate as a policeman in this time when you may have to be dealing with Goebbels and people like that. So that he's a very compromised character, Bernie Gunter, but very charismatic, bit of an alky, plenty to like about him.
And how many? 14 books in the
14,
series?
14, that's right, yes. So, I mean, in a way, if I was going to advise someone, you could start, weirdly enough, with his last one, Metropolis, which came out posthumously, because it's, you know, it's him in his early days. Mm. Otherwise, Pale Violets was actually the first one published nearly, 30 years ago. Mm. But I think a lot of people were really very sad when he died, because he had a real fan base who'd grown to love this character with all his flaws. And it's such an evocative setting. So, I mean, the TV series, if it comes out, ought to be very good. They've got Colin Firth in it as well. Mm. There we go, for the ladies.
We're talking about Jacob Elordi earlier, and now we're talking about Colin Firth.
Hottie Central here.
We've gone full circle. I want to ask you a bit of an impudent question, which how do you have time to read all these books? I mean, I know it's your job,
yes,
but you must have other books that you need to read anyway for your job. How are you? How many hours a day do you spend reading?
Well, I've got a huge to-be-read pile.
Of course, we all do.
So I have, let's say the weekend, I sort of nibble on lots of books, and if they don't give me any pleasure, I quickly chuck them. Ah. The most important rule is that, you know, give a book at least 20 pages.
Is that all, 20
yes,
pages?
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Well, sometimes it might not be, you might not, you know, like, pandas and procreation, you have to be in the right mood for certain books. So you put them away, put them on another TBR pile. But I think I spend all the time reading, one way or the other.
I think you do. Thank you so much for that, Robbie. That is Robbie Millen, literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. So it was the Caslett Chronicles, Confusion, Jan Morris, A Life by Sarah Wheeler, and Metropolis by Philip Kerr. Thank you very much for that. And people will have their own recommendations too. You know how to get in touch, 87222. You start your message with the word Times. You can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353, or you can always send us an email. That's a very civilised way of doing it, studio at times.radio. Coming up, our money doctor Adam Shaw will explain how to navigate the chaos and save money on those summer flights. It is 3:44. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening, Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Need anything from Tesco? Like Tesco finest hot cross buns. Any two for just £3 on selected packs this Easter with your Tesco club card. Because every little helps. Majority of larger stores selected finest buns end 6th of April. Club card or app required.
Elite athletes know performance isn't just about pushing harder, it's about smart recovery. That mindset sparked MyoMaster, founded by Lottie White and Harlequins rugby player Joe Gray, now a thriving recovery brand. As MyoMaster grew, Lottie knew their finances needed to perform at the same level as their products. That's why they chose Xero accounting software. MyoMaster uses Xero for making tax digital for VAT. They've seen how taking your finances digital strengthens a business. And from April 6th, making tax digital for income tax means many sole traders and landlords must keep digital records and submit quarterly updates. MyoMaster's advice? Don't see MTD as just compliance. See it as a performance upgrade. Xero brings MyoMaster's sales, payroll and VAT into one place, giving Lottie confidence in her compliance and the insight to plan her next moves. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio, sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. They are back tomorrow. And John Pienaar, of course, is here at 4 o'clock on Times Radio with Drive. Now, as the war in the Middle East continues, oil prices are going up and airlines will, of course, see higher fuel costs, which could hit travellers. Summer's right around the corner. If you want to save some serious money on your next holiday, when and how you book can make a real difference of hundreds, sometimes thousands of pounds. So please listen up. Our money doctor, Adam Shaw, is here to guide us through some of the ways to keep costs down and protect your money. Afternoon to you, Adam.
Hello.
First of all, is there still a cheapest day to fly?
Yes.
Is
the answer. I have to say it's got harder because, I can't remember the last time I was on a plane which wasn't full.
Yeah.
And so the airlines have got very clever with their algorithms at pricing it just right. So I think there was a time when planes flew large, you'd see empty seats. Well, I haven't seen that for ages.
Yeah.
And there was also a time when I remember overbooking. You'd sometimes go, who would not want to fly today for 100? I'll give you 100 quid and you hold on, you go till 200 quid. It's now very precise. So they see what we're doing and they match what we're doing. And often the thing is, you fly on a Friday. You fly on a Friday, finish work, let's get away really quickly on the Saturday. So those are the most expensive times to fly as a result because they're very popular and the spaces at the airports are fixed. Mm. You can't squeeze in more flights. Generally, it depends on where you're going, but generally Tuesdays and Wednesdays.
I'm writing this down.
That's research by the travel company Kayak found that Tuesdays and Wednesdays were the best time to fly, especially for longer international flights. So if you can get a sort of Wednesday to Wednesday holiday, that would be often the cheapest. It's harder if you're getting a package because often they go Friday. Or if you're booking an Airbnb, it might go, well, we're only going to do Friday to Friday or whatever. But if you've got the flexibility to book Tuesday to Tuesday, Wednesday to Wednesday, that'll often get you the best flights.
The difficulty here, I suppose, of course, is that, you know, empty seats is a failure for the airline.
Yeah.
But as you say, they know everything about us because there must be some necessary cookies attached there. But also we have different working habits and, there may be people who can leave on a Thursday rather than a Friday.
Well,
how much is that
home,
changing at all?
Well, I was going to say working from home or working from the beach. So some people do this surreptitiously. Who knows where you are? If you're just doing it from a bedroom, it could be a bedroom at home or a bedroom in a hotel. And some companies, I've heard increasingly, are very flexible about that. I think perhaps they take a realistic view that people are going to do it anyway. And they go, look, let's just be honest.
Yeah.
In a way, what do I care if you're doing it from the outskirts of Manchester or the outskirts of Malaga? If you're doing your work, and therefore that flexibility might help you get extra cheap deals.
So you've said Tuesday and Wednesday, be flexible, etc. Anything? Are there any other internet hacks you can suggest to find the best there is?
Yes. So obviously, looking around for if you're looking at flights, only things like Google Flight or Skyscanner are really good ways, but it sort of looks around the whole market and shows you what's on offer. In addition to that, Skyscanner in particular have a bit called The Drop, and I think they've got a Drop app, and what they do is they scan all the flights and they highlight those which have dropped 20% or more from the long-term price. So if you actually go, I don't care where I go, I just want a good deal.
Who does that?
Well, loads of people do that. You might not go, hey, look, I just want to be somewhere hot. I don't care if it's Spain, if it's Greece, if it's France. What do I care? Therefore, you look at things like Drop, We'll show you where you get some unusually good deals. They also do something else. Where if you, it sounds like you do care where you go, right? So let's say you do care and you want to go. Well, I looked up Manchester to Malaga. And I go, I'm flying from Manchester and I want to go to Malaga. And I'm flexible when I go. I just want a good deal. Yeah. They do a feature which draws a graph of when the best time to book for any particular flight is. Right. So I did that for yesterday from Manchester to Malaga. For that particular flight, the best time to book is 5 weeks ahead. And it draws a very significant graph. If you're booking... Oh, you're writing that down again? I should have looked London to Malaga. You know, that rises very significantly, that flight, in the week or two before you fly. So that, again, is a really good hack.
Okay. What about, you know, oil prices obviously on the up. What's happening in terms of the a fuel surcharge?
Yeah. So fuel surcharges can be a thing where the airlines get hit with an surprising large rise, and oil is a big part of their cost. And we have already seen this. Cathay Pacific, for instance, largely flying to Asia, has increased fuel charges for travellers. It says they've only 30% of their fuel is hedged. So that means what they do is they know that oil is unpredictable, even in normal times. So they buy it ahead. They go, right, we're going to guarantee a price in the future. They haven't done a lot of that. And anyway, all the airlines will now be facing big rises. The truth is they've probably hedged for the next few months, but coming up, they're having to hedge now for a year ahead, perhaps. Now, that could mean... I'm not saying it does, but it could mean that if you paid for it now, you've booked in today's price what might be much heavier in the future.
Yeah.
If you've already booked a flight, the price is normally fixed because by law, the airlines have to include all unavoidable charges like fuel in the ticket price. If you book a package holiday, there can be a fuel surcharge. If it's more than 8%, they have to tell you about it and you've got the right to cancel. But there is an argument to say, you know, if you know where you're going,
don't book a package holiday.
You know, yes, but also book it now before the price rises.
Yeah.
But look, these things are flexible. We live in such uncertain times.
Yeah.
The rules might change. So do check that before you book.
Well, on the uncertain times point, travel insurance. Yeah. Now, I know travel insurance is... I'm often quite surprised at the fact that a lot of people don't have it. And I understand it's an extra cost, but, you know, I would always get it. According to ABTA, a quarter of those who went on holiday between April 2024 and April 2025 travelled without any insurance.
Yeah.
A lot of the people in who were on flights that were all over the place because of what was happening in Iran, they said that they weren't covered anyway because, you know, acts of war, etc., those kind of attacks were excluded.
Well, so first of all, I agree. It's sort of shocking how many people travel without any insurance. And it's particularly strong amongst the younger people. So between those aged 25 and 34, ABTA's research showed that 40% of those travel without insurance.
Mm.
You might understand why. Maybe they've got a more laissez-faire attitude to life. Maybe they have less money to do that. But I would always book insurance. And more to the point, I think often people book, it's a boring thing to do. You book the lovely holiday and then you think about insurance. You might book it the week before you travel. But if you do that, you're not covered for anything that happens between the booking and the flight or the time you book it. So it's really a good idea to book the insurance
when
you
book the holiday.
Yeah. And therefore, you're covered. If there's an international emergency or a family emergency or anything, or your personal emergency, you should be covered in that insurance. The other thing people miss out, to be clear, cruise cover, much more expensive, and it's not normally covered. Skiing cover, also not normally covered. But also to look out, if you've got a packaged bank account, so if you pay for your bank account, it comes with extras, often travel insurance is included. And I know a lot of people buy travel insurance without realising they've already got it for free. So do check that out. The other thing is, GHIC and EHIC cards offer you basic cover, sort of as a national in a European country would get. EHIC cards existed when we were in the EU. They've been replaced by GHIC cards. They're super easy to apply for. I so rarely say this. Government websites are normally pants. this is a really good website. It's through the NHS. It costs you nothing. Mm-hmm. I applied for it at the weekend, and then it reminded me I've already got it. And I went, oh, yeah. But it reminded me really quickly, you've got that. It only took five minutes.
So remind us, what does a GHIC card entitle you to?
It entitles you to necessary state health care in European economic areas and a few other countries.
Okay.
The NHS say this is not a replacement for insurance, but since it's free, it could get you some basic cover anyway. And it's so easy to apply for, it's just mad not to do it. And it covers you for years. I mean, you don't have to do it every time you travel. I'd got it because I think it lasts 5-6 years.
Some people are apparently using their shopping loyalty points to get discounted holidays. How do we get into this, Adam?
Yeah, so lots of them. So Sainsbury's, Nectar Points, Tesco Club Cards also have a system. It's interesting. I'm sort of pausing because when you go onto the Tesco or the Sainsbury's Club Card website and portals, it looks fantastic. However, it might be that you could actually get it cheaper direct. So whereas it's really worth looking at, it's worth checking independently. And the same goes for British Airways Avios points. I've looked at that before. And because you get the flight for free, but they cost you they charge taxes on top. Mm. I've sometimes found it's easier to go pay the whole thing with EasyJet or Ryanair than actually go supposedly for free with my Avios points, because British Airways will charge me lots of sort of tax extras on top of that. Yeah. So, but having said all of that, it's really appealing to get points with your butter and your bread, and you get a free trip abroad or to, you know, entertainment in the UK.
I want to try to squeeze in, if we can, just a general point about kind of war zones and where you should be booking and where you should know that you shouldn't be booking. But just quickly, credit cards themselves, which ones should be used abroad?
Yeah, so look out for non-sterling transaction fees. That's the key phrase. It'll charge you a bit extra every time you're abroad, but there's no reason to pay that. There are lots of cards which don't charge it. Comes to mind Lloyd's Ultra Visa credit card, Halifax Clarity credit card, Monzo, for instance, which is not a credit card but has a debit card, also claims there are no extra fees. And there's lots other really easy to Google or Bing or your search engine of choice, whatever it is. But you should be looking for non-sterling transaction fee free credit cards.
Right. Now, you said it yourself, the world is a uncertain place right now. And there will have been people. I mean, I had a friend who was in Cape Town on holiday for her birthday, and she was coming back via Dubai. And obviously she couldn't, and she was kind of stuck out there for 6 or 7 extra days. So there was no way that she was going to know that was going to happen to her.
Of course, yeah.
Presumably there are people who just need to be across the news and know where are the danger zones and where are not.
Well, no, I don't think. I mean, you always have to be across the news and tuned into Times Radio at all times, obviously. But if you're worried at all, if you're going anywhere out of your ordinary to the sort of regular package holidays in Spain or whatever, the Foreign Office, you look at the Foreign Office website and it will give you very clear advice of whether you should travel or not. If you travel against that advice, if you can actually get to a place which they're advising you against, your insurance is probably null and void anyway. So you'd have to have a really good reason to do that. There may be a good reason to travel to those places. You may have family there, for instance, you need to help out. But you should be aware that if you are doing that against government advice, that you are probably not covered and you'll be on your own. I think the bigger thing to ask of your insurance is actually whether you are covered if you get stuck in a country and you can't get back, and what happens to the hotel bills.
That is probably the most important question. Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Adam Shaw. He's written a guide for us on how to save money on holiday this year. You can find it at themoneydoctor.tv or on his socials. It's Adam Shaw Biz, of course. That is it from me. What a pleasure it has been to be on this radio station, to speak to you all again. Thanks for your texts. Jane and Fee are back tomorrow. I'll be back in April. And John Pienaar is next on Times Radio with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Asma. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Keir Starmer has said it's not a simple task to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, but he's working with allies on a viable plan. And a nursery worker has been sentenced to 24 years in jail and a further six on licence for sexually abusing toddlers in his care in Bristol. And coming up, the Prime Minister is resisting Donald Trump's call to send warships to help secure the Strait of Hormuz, saying Britain will not be dragged into a war. Now, what does that leave the so-called special relationship? Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mihailova, and the Times policy editor, Oliver Wright, are going to be joining me, and we'll be talking about this. Well, the closest, perhaps, was it, we've ever got to Keir Starmer having a Love Actually moment.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. So Keir Starmer says a decision on how to reopen the Strait of Hormuz may be some time away. Donald Trump has demanded that seven countries help to unblock the waterway, which carries a fifth of the world's oil. The Prime Minister stressed this would need a coalition of countries. Here's the Times' White Hall editor, Ben Clatworthy.
The key messages were that we should that de-escalation is the way to maintain stability, but also the big message was cost of living. And he was saying that the way to keep the cost of living down is through de-escalation. The longer the war goes on, the worse the pain is going to be domestically.
The Prime Minister's pledged £53 million in extra support for those households that are most exposed to rising heating oil prices. A GP surgery in Kent has warned patients to stay away and go straight to A&E if they're showing symptoms of meningitis. A student and a year at 13 schoolgirl have tragically died and 11 remain seriously ill in hospital following an invasive outbreak of the disease in Canterbury. Hundreds of students at the University of Kent have been queuing for antibiotics at the campus. Dr. Tom Nutts from Meningitis Now and has this advice for those in the area.
I think it's about remaining vigilant to the fact that there is disease in the community. I would be paying special attention to loved ones, people around you, you know, if they become unwell with those signs and symptoms that we talked about. And if someone is unwell and starting to deteriorate, then I think they should seek urgent medical help, either by phoning 111 or 999 or possibly going to A&E if someone is seriously unwell.
The Times website has a comprehensive list of possible symptoms and information on how the disease spreads. A judge has called a nursery worker an incorrigible and dangerous paedophile as he jailed him for 24 years for sexually abusing children. Nathan Bennett's victims in Bristol were just 2 and 3 years old. The alarm was raised when his actions were picked up on CCTV, watched by staff. Senior Crown Prosecutor Gemma Kneebone says Bennett's offendings was one of the most appalling and upsetting she's ever seen.
When we send our children to school or to preschool or to nursery each day, we do so trusting that they will be cared for and kept safe. Bennett took advantage of that trust, seeking out a profession that gave him access to the most vulnerable of victims.
Senior Labour sources have described it as shameful that party funds were used to cover the cost of a specialist tax lawyer hired to look into Angela Rayner's finances. It was prior to her resignation as Deputy Prime Minister last year. Jonathan Peacock KC spent up to 5 days examining Rayner's finances, providing a draft and final legal advice about the purchase of a £700,000 flat in Hove. And Chelsea have been hit with an £11 million fine by the Premier League over unregistered payments to agents and other individuals during transfers. The payments were self-reported by the current owners, but took place under the previous ownership of Roman Abramovich. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, the Western Alliance is being driven closer to breaking point by the war in the Gulf. Or maybe it's more accurate to say driven closer to breaking point by President Trump, who's now warned quite extraordinarily that America's allies must deploy warships to the Straits of Hormuz to guard shipping from Iranian attack or suffer punitive consequences, or as he put it, a bad future. So far, of the seven or so countries who've received that ultimatum, the number that's agreed to or yielded to that demand from the president is precisely zero, either because they refuse to accept the legality of the attack on Iran or because they see no clear plan or outcome for the military campaign, or because they consider sending warships to the Strait to face attack simply too dangerous. And among them, Keir Starmer. He's talking of a coordinated response, maybe involving drones. He clearly doesn't want a confrontation with Donald Trump, but he's got one. And this could be a defining moment, not just for the Western Alliance, but for Starmer and his leadership. So on today's programme, let us look at the latest on the war, at Starmer's response, at Starmer's leadership, and at plans to help less well-off Brits through the impact of the building energy crisis. And at the way, of course, the Atlantic Alliance is being strained as rarely before. What are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Let's just listen back. Keir Starmer speaking at that news conference this morning. He restated that Britain won't be joining the war.
Our priority is always the national interest. And so we have been clear and consistent in our objectives throughout this conflict. First, we will protect our people in the region. Second, while taking the necessary action to defend ourselves and our allies, we will not be drawn into the wider war.
The Prime Minister also promised a package to help deal with the rising cost of living as the conflict continues to push up oil prices. This is after reports that oil and energy suppliers are cancelling orders and raising prices.
Because it's clear this market is under-regulated, we're going to put that right to ensure customers get a better deal. But we won't just wait for that. I'm announcing immediate support for vulnerable heating oil customers today, providing £53 million for those households that are most exposed.
It's Keir Starmer speaking earlier. It's now welcome to the programme, Anna Mikhailova, Times Radio's political editor. Hello, Anna.
Hi, John.
Hi, and Ollie Wright, the Times policy editor here too. Hi to you, Ollie.
Hello.
Anna, can I come to you first? I mean, the Prime Minister is looking a serious challenge in the face here. What do you make, having watched him this morning, what do you make of how he's handling the occasion and himself?
Well, he's very keen to tread this tightrope of, on the one hand, sticking to this position of not entering the war and not taking a full-throttled approach to helping Donald Trump, but also not completely criticising him. So he's on the one hand saying that he's going to effectively stand up to pressure from Donald Trump. He's saying his position hasn't shifted, and he presented it, as you heard just now, in quite strong language. He mentioned the Iraq war once again. He said that this is all founded on principle with him. All of this, John, is music to the ears of many Labour backbenchers.
Yeah.
And also Labour members and supporters. But the tricky thing is that he's also not going so far as to